Hey, so this morning, if you would flip open in your Bibles to Judges chapter 4. Judges chapter 4 is where we're going to be at today, and we've been in the book of Judges. Last week, one of the things that, I don't know how well I introduced it or whatever, but I think this is true, and I think it's going to help us get to where we need to go today. And it has to do with the faculties of this world. And we talked about, I wasn't talking about a faculty that's on a school staff or administration, but it's the faculties. It's the things that make up the powers of this world. On some level, God uses all those faculties to foster and facilitate his purposes in life. So maybe this is just a oversimplified way of looking at it, and it is a little bit, but I would just say that God's always at work in everything. And it's really hard as a person, unless something is just egregiously sin, and even to that extent, God's moving in those particular ways to bring about his purposes in all things. But what you got to figure out in your life is what's the truth that you're going to trust? And on some level, let me just say it like this. We all trust some sort of truth. We all live, and it's just kind of like, even if you say that you don't have any guiding principles that you live by, that's a guiding principle to live by. Does that make sense? You don't have to have an axiom statement or a maxim statement posted on your door frame when you walk in to know. But this is what I want you to know, is that in the Old Testament, specifically the Israelites, they had a maxim that they lived by. And some of you all know this maxim really, really well. But this was the maxim. It was, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your mind, and with all your strength." And we get this out of Deuteronomy. They have this little thing called the Shema. And they would post the Shema on their door frames, on their doorposts. They would say it before they got up. They would say it before they go down. They had a truth that they were all trying to live by and hold near and dear to their heart. And what I would say is, and this is, if you're like a lot of people, sometimes you put a lot of thought and investment and time into what are the truths that you're going to live by, and sometimes you don't. Sometimes you literally make it up as you go, or you just kind of figure things out as it happens. You all know this, I work with college students, and I have a lot of college students that will come in, and freshman year, or I'll meet them at orientation and stuff like that. And I'll start the pitch of why they should get involved with our ministry, or why they should at least start considering it, or just come to an event. It's kind of crazy to me, some of the responses I get back, because you can tell they just haven't thought about it a whole lot. They're like, "Well, I don't I'm going to make my own decisions. I'm just going to get in there and kind of figure it out, as I go." And they'll say that with their religious life, and I don't always say this back. Sometimes I do. It just depends on my mood, really, how feisty I want to be that day. But the thing is, the fault with that is that the moment that they arrive on campus, somebody has a plan for them. If they're in engineering, they have a 4-year every semester prerequisite classes they have to all fulfill and all that kind of, in order to meet the ultimate criteria of them getting a degree that finishes out their college experience so they can move on and do whatever they're doing next. And this is kind of how it operates in the university setting. Whether or not you come in and say you have a plan or not, somebody has a plan for you. Does that make sense? And so what God has always kind of been in the business of is he's always tried to help us say, hey, I have a plan for your life if you'll trust me. If you'll allow my truths in an unwavering type of way to be what guides your life. But also in the same type of manner, you don't have to let God do nothing. And so today, what we're going to look at in Judges chapter 4, and the really core truth that's there, is that God's truth is trustworthy. It just is. And I mean that in a simple sense of reading the Bible and making sense of it. And there's a very practical just sense that all of us are guided by some sort of truths. And you can say, that's the thing, Like, you can say that you don't, or you can say that you're figuring out, or you can say that you don't know, but that doesn't mean that you're not operating on some kind of truths. And what I would like to submit to you today, at least, is one, I think there is an incredible truth that exists in the Scriptures that's reliable. And I think if you're not at a place where you really are trusting it, I think it's worth your time to consider trusting it. And some of you all, I guess these are the three camps. You're not trusting it, and maybe you should consider it more than what you're doing. You say that you trust it, but your life does not reflect that trust. And we're going to get into that today pretty intensely, is like when people say that they trust God and they don't. And maybe it's this, and maybe this is just where you're at. Like, you do trust God. And you trust God, and you're trying as best you can to be directed towards what God wants you to do. And I would say this, sometimes that works out for you, you know this. And sometimes it's not always easy to say, hey, I'm directed at God and I'm trusting Him. And so that's what we're going to, let's talk about this. So I want you to know this, if any other truth that comes out of today is God's truth is trustworthy. You can trust God. And so this is what it says in Judges chapter 4. So Judges is the seventh book of the Bible. This is what it says in verse 1. There's, just so you know, that there's five movements in this particular chapter. The whole story, it takes up an entire chapter. Starts in verse 1 and ends in verse 24. There's five particular movements. I'll go ahead and give you the movements, and that will kind of help you outline it. There's a movement from 1 to 10. There's another movement from 11 to 14. There's another movement from 15 to 17. And then there's another movement from 18 to 22. And then the last movement in this particular story is 23 and 24. So those are the kind of the five particular areas that we're going to look at today. And there's truths that exist in each one of those. Some of them are more significant than others. But those are, the way they do this in stories is there's one act, and that's Judges chapter 4, and there's five different scenes. And each one of those scenes helps us understand the ultimate truth, which is actually the last scene in Judges chapter 4. So this is what it says. The Israelites again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud had died. And we've talked about this before. There's a cycle that exists in the book of Judges where there's peace in the land, and then what the people end up doing is they allow foreign gods and foreign deities into their life, and they stop worshiping God. And this is how this is described. It's called evil, and it's called evil every time. So I don't know. If you've kind of worked through this before with Jesus, he kind of changed the game on a lot of stuff. The devil is not Jesus' arch enemy. Like, the devil, Satan, the adversarial powers of this world, they're not equal to God. That's why they're not adversarial. Like, Jesus and Satan are not equals and opposites. Like, Jesus is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He reigns over all things. The best thing that you could describe Satan as being as just a thief or a rebel rouser who tries to take you off course of what the king wants out of his kingdom. So this is what happens. So they did again what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud had died. And this is a, you can underline sight of the Lord. This is a really incredible thought. And I want you to know this. Back to that faculties bit. God uses all the faculties of this world to foster and facilitate his own purposes. God uses your own faculties, your sight, your smell, your taste, your mental capacity. God uses all the faculties of your life in order to direct you towards what he wants you to be and become. Like, he uses all of that. And on some level, like, so let's say you walk through this hypothetical scenario where, like, you lose your hearing or you lose your sight or something like that. Does that mean that you have less faculties? Well, it does physically, but it doesn't mean that God can't use other faculties in a really stronger way. But this is the point. God needs every single part of you. He doesn't just need, like, your mind. Or he just doesn't need your mouth. Or he just doesn't need your hands and your feet. He needs all of it. What God asks of us, if you're going to believe in him, is that you would willfully lay down every part of your life. Paul picks this up in Romans chapter 12, where he says, offer your bodies as a living sacrifice to God. So the truth that's trusted, it begins with sacrifice. Some of you all know this because Jesus sacrificed the most. But in your own life, what God requires of you is that you would live your life as a living sacrifice. holy and pleasing to God. All the things that you do. Not just some of them, not just part of them, not just your Sunday mornings or your Sunday afternoons or your small group time, but every bit of it. Verse 2, it says this, "So the Lord sold them to King Jabin of the Canaan, who reigned in Hazor, and the commander of his armies was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth of the nations." Verse 3, it says this, "Then Israel cried out to the Lord because Jabin had 900 iron chariots, and he harshly oppressed them for 20 years. So if you want to underline this, this is a pretty neat little detail. In some of the other like stories that we get, this is how we know this is a descriptive detail that's important for us to know in terms of how the story works, is we didn't really get that much detail about some of the other armies that got conquered in the book of Judges. Or we didn't necessarily get like how many troops that they had or what their troops were like. But in this particular passage, it says that they had 900 troops, and it wasn't just some troops, but it was a specific troop. It was iron chariots. So Sisera and his army, they were a chariot-riding army. That's how they won their battles. They were fast, they were swift, they had steel, which was a really hard resource to come by. And not only did they have steel or they had iron, that they had forged and wielded and molded this steel into wheels and things like that. So it wasn't like, hey, you could just go burn down their chariots or whatever. Like, you could try to do a whole lot of stuff to them, and it wasn't going to work. Like, this army was built, this is what you got to do, to conquer folks. Like, it was built to win. It wasn't built to lose. This is what it says in verse 4. It says, "Deborah, a prophetess, and the wife of Labidoth, was judging Israel at that time." So Ehud was the judge. We talked about Ehud last time. And now Deborah becomes the judge. And it talks about that Deborah's husband was a prophet. And verse 5, it says, "And she would sit under the palm trees of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And then the Israelites went up to her, and they would settle their disputes." This is a really hard thing. Like, I'm sure none of y'all have like really been to Ephraim. They don't call it that anymore. And I don't think you've ever described your house as like the house of palms or anything like that. The idea that lies behind these particular verses is she was comfortable. What she was doing, the way that she was doing it, is she had a nice life, man. But in verse 1, does it not say that there was evil that the Israelites were doing in the eyes of the Lord? I don't know this, and we're not going to talk about this really that much. Sometimes the worst places for you to be in life is really comfortable. You stop relying on God. Sometimes you resist the things of God because you're so like comfortable like in what you're doing and how you're living, how much money you make, what that money allows you to buy, what type of money you make, how that allows your cyclical calendar of the yearly. Sometimes the worst place for you to be is just chilling. Because if it makes sense. But if you're resting in your own power, it means that you're not resting in God's power. In the seventh day of creation, it says that God rests. And maybe we've talked about this before. The idea that's there is that God doesn't run on carbohydrates, right? He doesn't need an AMP energy drink to get through his day. What God does is he puts all things into motion and then he reigns over it, meaning that everything is functioning according to how he designed it, and he's watching it unfold. And in your life, in your own power, you can rest in your own strength, or in your own life, you can rest in God's power. And I'll just say this, I don't think this is meant to be overly complicated, but I do think this, I think practical application. I think you have 365 days in a year. And I think it's worth asking God at some point in time in a regular calendar, God, what do you want to happen and what do you want to accomplish out of my life this year? Like, what are the things that you want me and my family and my spouse and my children, like, what do you want us to invest in? I'll say this, and I don't know, I'm the husband of a children's minister, and VBS is a big deal in our house. And I'm just going to say this, and this is just me talking, so you can do whatever. It makes no sense. This statistically, most people come to faith and come to know the Lord at camps and at vacation Bible school. I mean, like, It is that specific from the statistics that we know. That's where most of the action spiritually in somebody's life happens in their life. It's not that other things don't manifest good stuff, but those two things, it's like 90% of kids and students come to know the faith, come to know God at those particular places. So this is my question. When you're looking through your 365, how do you not plan and prioritize that time? Like, even as a single person, like somebody that might not have any kids or whatever, and you're saying of God, hey, this is what I want you to do. I want you to use my life to invest in other people's lives. And one of the biggest ways that God continues to use, like, it's really simple, it's format. I get it. It's wild. It's nuts. There's, like, water flying through the air, dirty diapers flying through the air, you know, vacation Bible school. Like, it's crazy. But how do you not look at your 365 and say, hey, God, I'm going to try to prioritize this in a way that honors and glorifies, because you use this. I just say this. I don't get it. And I'm not critiquing anybody's life or anything like that. It back to the whole, like, going into college and acting like you don't have a plan. It makes no sense to look over your 365 and act like, well, I'm just going to do whatever, like, knee-jerk wants to happen this year. It's not the way that you were designed to be. You're meant to trust God. You're meant to trust God with your time. And you're meant to trust God with your planning. Like, so, well, this is what you're also saying. And I'll tell you this story because I think it's worthwhile. I have a friend. He's really not in a great place with his marriage and with his kids. Actually, to hear his wife tell the story, she actually thought that they were headed towards a divorce. And he was a business guy. And peak sales for his company were in March. Well, the church that I was at the time, that's when they did their men's retreat, was during March, and it was a weekend. And this is what happened. One of the guys in the church really went after this dude. He could sense something was not right in his marriage, not right with something. And the guy just pursued and pursued and pursued. He said, hey, man, you're coming on this retreat with me. I don't care what's going to happen, you're coming. And he was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, he just kind of did the whole, like, yeah, I'll go, whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And he got up to the week before. He said, hey, man, I've already paid for you to be able to come. I'll meet you here Friday afternoon. And he goes, well, I got, and he's like, no, man, you're already paid for. There's no refund on the deposit. You're like, you're a grown man. I've been telling you about this. You're going. And he's like, fine. Well, what ended up happening in his business that week is, like, stuff started to pick up. And by what, when I mean stuff started to pick up, when he tells the story, it was like he has a normal salary in his business of sales, which, you know, it's like accumulated over time. He was doing like plus 3K, plus 5K, plus 8K, plus 9K. And rolling into the weekend, whenever he makes like, would make the big money, I mean, his projection was he probably would have made 30 grand in a weekend. And they get to the men's retreat stuff, and he just tells the guy, he's like, hey, man, like, I gotta work. And he said, you're not. Like, you're not working this weekend, man. He's like, okay, I'll go, but I got to have my phone on me. He's like, you're not going to have your phone on you. Actually, you're going to give me your phone right now. He's like, I'm not a child. He's like, I know. That's why you're going to give me your phone, because you're an adult. And, man, This happened 5 years ago. And when he tells this story, what happened in that weekend is he realized that he was in an evil place with God. And he would admit that his marriage was headed straight towards a divorce because he wasn't planning anything. He didn't care anymore. He was just losing all ability to really function in his family. And that weekend, what God did, in a metaphorical sense, is he just ripped this dude open. He got in his heart, he got in his life. He used other men to get in his heart and get in his life, speak real truth. And this was what was real. 30K is not the substitute for a bad life. It's not a substitute for a bad marriage. It's not the substitute for anything. Like, there's no amount of money in your life that will ever substitute the passion and the pride and the purpose that God has for people and the people that are in your life, like your kids, your wife, your family. Like, there's no substitute for that. And to let all kinds of other things into your life and to prioritize those things over, like, your family and like, good friends and stuff like that, You can do whatever you want, but that it will not lead for you a meaningful life. And I'll just say this, when you trust God with all of your time. And so what I would look at, and I don't maybe need to do it today, is I would work through your 365. And I would just say, like, hey God, this, I mean, here's an easy example of this. Just think of it like this. God, on some level, you're not going to go wrong by giving God 10% of your time. So just look through your year and say, okay, how much is 10% of my year? What's about 2 weeks? How can you use 2 weeks throughout your year to give it to God? Like, how can you literally plan time in order to honor God with your life? 2 weeks. Verse 6, this is what it says. Deborah summoned Barak, son of Ammonon, from Kadesh to Naphtali, and he said, "Hasn't the Lord God commanded you, go deploy the troops on Mount Tamar and take with you 10,000 men from Naphtali and Zebulun, the Naphtalonites and the Zebulunites?" Verse 7, "Then I will lure Sisera, commander of Jabin's army, his chariots and his infantry at the Wadi Kishon to fight against you, and I will hand him over to you." Verse 8, this is what it says. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. And if you could just bold this, highlight it, underline it, underscore it, the way that this is in this first scene, this is the climax text that exists in this subcategory here. And I want you to know this, that God wants your obedience. And this is the way this kind of works in this text. He tells Deborah, hey, I'll go and do this deal, but you got to go with me. And you can read the next one where she says, I will gladly go with you, but you will not receive the honor on the road you're about to take because the Lord will sell Sisera to a woman. And the gender bit doesn't matter there. It's the obedience bit that's really at play here. It says, listen, if you are really not going to be obedient to me, God's still going to manifest his purposes in this whole bit. Like, there's a war that's going to be waged, and God's ultimate end is to win the war. But the nuts and bolts and pieces in the middle of how it comes about, like, if you would have gone by yourself because you're a big boy, it would have worked out for you. But because you won't and I got to go with you, it's not going to be you. And I'll say this, big picture kind of deal. And this, there's a lot of comfort in this. You got to know that God wins. Like, there's a victory that's found in the triumph of Christ. And there's a victory to be found in your life. I'll say this. Maybe you know somebody, and maybe I'm just speaking way out of my neck right now. And that's fine if I am. I do that a good bit. Like, I'll just apologize for it later or whatever. I don't know anybody. And by meaning, you know, in marriage counseling and stuff like that, they tell you, like, don't use, like, every type statements and all, like you yell at me all the time because it's not true, right? And I'm just going to say this. Like, I don't know anybody. And by anybody, I mean anybody. That when they truly give all of their every minute life to God and ask God to bless it and to honor it and to work through it and to manifest his glory and his power and his presence and all the good things that come, I don't know anybody that sells out towards that particular end and gets to the end of their life and been like, man, I wish I would have done this another way, Becky. Like, I don't know anybody. Like, I just don't know the people that invest like that, that look, get to the end of their life and don't think, man, this just all wasn't worth it. But I can tell you, countless stories, man, of average, common, everyday people that give all, not just part, but all of their life to God. They're 365, they're 457, like any kind of number that you can calculate, any kind of time or principles or whatever. They give it all to God. And they get to the end of their life, and it's not like they were this incredible CEO or businessman. There's some people that are like that, but they're just regular folks, you know, and they get to the end of their life and say, like, man, this was all worth it. And I'll just say this as a point of success. And this is where I think, like, man, there's just a lot of work to be done in this category. Like, right now, the term that we look at for success of somebody's life is when they get to the end of their life, they look at, like, what's their retirement like? What's their bank account like? How many houses do they have? How many homes? How many cars do they drive? What are the toys that they own? That is just not the formula or the recipe for a successful life. Like, it's just not. Like, the formula and the recipe for successful life, and this is what God continues to show his people out of the book of Judges, is that you live your life sold out to God. And if that means that you have a lot of toys and houses and cars and whatever, like, that's fine, that's cool, but it's not the ultimate aim. It's actually an aim that will never fulfill. What do you mean by that? I mean this. One of the key things that we think about Jesus is that Jesus was the bread of life. Simple way of putting it. Jesus is the sustenance of our souls. And in that, Jesus' sustenance, it satisfies us. Meaning that, like, the more you get of God, the more you get of Jesus, like, the more you find contentment. So, put it in a different way. That some of these other things, they just don't sell. Like, and I don't know, like, you know, we got two cars, and we barely have two cars. It seems like we wreck one every other week or something like that. But, like, it seems to me like, well, at the end of, like, the material monetized gain part, it's like, well, you get one thing, well, you really just want another. It's like, when Robert finally buys his boat, you know what I mean? Well, then he's going to want a nice side-by-side, you know what I mean? Because, like, he's got to go deer hunting, you know what I mean? Like, right now he can only fish in a flat bottom, you know what I mean? But he's going to get a big boat one day. And it just seems like when you start aiming towards the material cause, all that does is once that's fulfilled, you just shift. Why? Because you've already accomplished and conquered it. Like, once you got the boat, well, then it's like, well, I got to find something else. And you just keep working. And that's why, like, some people, it's not just to say I have, like, one car. They have, like, 50,000 cars, you know what I mean? Like, and they're all cool, you know what I mean? And I don't know. We're way off right now. But this is just what I want you to know. Like, what Jesus promises us is he promises to satisfy our soul with his own sustenance. And when you're satisfied in him, your contentment in life doesn't come from anything else. Like, it just comes from him. And so, if you'll look at verse 11, we'll kind of work on down. But the condemnation that exists here for Barak is he's really not in a place where he's really ready to trust God. He's got to have somebody else come along. And so this is what it says in verse 11. It says, Now Heber, the Kenite, had moved away from the Kenites and the son of Hobab, Moses' father-in-law, and pitched his tent inside the oak tree of Zemanin, which was near Kadesh. And I'm mispronouncing some of these. You just kind of roll through it. It was reported that to Sisera that Barak, son of Abinon, had gone up Mount Tabor, and Sisera summoned all of his 900 chariots and all the troops who were there with him from Harosheth of the nations to the Wadi Kishon. So 11 through 14, what's the point that's there? This is what I want you to know, that there is a trajectory that is of evil. And once evil gets on that trajectory, it does not stop. And it does not stop even at wisdom's sake. So what do I mean by that? Just very, this is as simple as I can make it. When evil is headed down the train tracks of accomplishment, it does not turn for any man or woman or any wisdom. It just does. And so what do I mean by that? In your life, you need to be really hesitant towards people that they are solely determined and bent, regardless of the information that gets brought into their life, to not change their mind about anything. You need to be super weary of those type of people. Because this is the characteristics that's given in this particular text of evil. Is like there's knowledge in the land that the Lord's going to give them over, and they do not care. Sisera's coming, baby. And you know what he's coming with? He's coming with 900 iron chariots. You know what I mean? Because nobody conquers Sisera. He's a conquering agent for Jabin, the Canaanite god. And I'll just say this. There's plenty of applications for this in your life. But be super weary about people and places and things and systems that they do not turn about at wisdom's cause. They just don't. So this is what I said, verse 14. The next scene. Then Deborah said to Barak, go, This is the day that the Lord has handed Sisera over to you. Hasn't the Lord gone before you? This is what I want you to know. This is a super easy, tangible, legible deal. God has already gone before you. He just is. He's already working. I remember this. I lived in New Orleans for a bit. And when I lived in New Orleans, one of the things that I helped was a part of is I helped plant a church in an area that was just a rough part of town. That's the way that I say it. We moved into a particular area. So it's a pretty diverse area in New Orleans. Like this block, which was like probably just a little bit bigger than like the property of this church. I mean, that's how big a block was. And there was like 10,000 people that lived in this block. Like it was just not very big, and there were a lot of people there. Well, there wasn't tons of white people that lived there, and I come to figure out, like, you know, we moved in, and, you know, we were pretty friendly or whatever, like me and the guys, because we were, like, seminary students, and we, you know, tried to honor God, so we weren't, like, super mean or whatever. Well, there was a lady that lived right across the street from us. She's a black lady, and she was older, and some of the family kind of lived with her. Well, every morning when I went out to take out the trash and that kind of stuff, and I went to work, like, at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. When I go out, she would be out there, and she sat on her porch. She sat on her porch every morning. And I didn't know her name, but we just moved into the area, so I was trying to get to know her. And I would just wave at her, be like, hey, how are you doing this morning? And I'm telling you, for weeks, I'd be like, hey, how are you doing? She's like... this is just the perseverance. Like, back to that wisdom's cause, you know what I mean? Like, just foolishness is, you know, super persevering in what it does. So I just, you know, like I wasn't going to take that. You know what I mean? Like, so I just kept waving, you know. And there was one morning I'd taken out the trash, and she was taking out the trash. So we were like from me to Robert. You know what I mean? And I just said, hey, how you doing? You know what I mean? Like, just real loud. Like, she just, no engagement from this lady. And she turned around, and she flew a finger that has used for not, you know, good communicational skills. And I was just like... like, you are the meanest person, you know. I didn't say that to her. I was just like, what in the world, you know. And so this is what happened. This is what I come to learn and figure out, is that the only white people that lived in that particular area were drug dealers. And her son was actually, at that particular time, he was in jail for drugs, for like possession of drugs. So she was mad. And she was mad at people that she perceived to deal drugs. And so what's the point? The point is that God gives over the day. So what ended up winning her over was actually not me being super jolly or whatever. There's one day this particular situation had happened where they had like this excessive amount of trash. They had thrown like a couple parties or whatever, and they had a bunch of trash, and back to the gospel and the trash cans bit. So I rolled my trash can out, and our trash can wasn't super full. And I see that, man, she's like stacking bags on the side of the trash can, and she's waiting for the trash guys to come because they don't take the bags. What she was going to do, she was going to run out there and start throwing them in the trash can, you know. Like, she was that kind of crafty, you know. And I just told her, I was like, hey, you can put those trash bags in my trash can. And she was just like, I'm not going to do it. I was like, then when you go back up to your porch, I'm going to get your trash bags and stick them in my trash can. Like, this can go however you want it to go. And so... so she did. So she walked back to the porch, and I picked her trash bags up and put them in my trash can. And she's just like, who are you? I just remember this. She said, who are you? I was like, well, I'm nobody, really. You know what I mean? I'm just like somebody that's trying to help you get your trash taken to the trash can. You know what I mean? But me and her, what ended up happening that day, and she was an older lady, I told her, I was like, hey, me and my buddies over here, we're in seminary, and we're actually planning a church. It's right around the corner there. It's called Level Ground Community Church. And I don't know if you go to church and that kind of stuff, but we're helping plan this church in this community because we think there's not really a church in this community, and we would like for there to be one. And I don't know if that's down with you. I don't know if that sounds good to you or whatever, but that's what we're trying to do. We're just trying to share with people there's a new church that's starting in this area, and we would like for you to be a part of it if you want to be. And she's like, oh, well, that's great. I go to this church down 3 miles down. You know what I mean? I was just like, all that for that, you know what I mean? Like, all that for that. The truth that exists there is I didn't know it. She didn't know it. We both were blissfully ignorant of each other's presence. God is already working. He works in people. He works in places. He works in situations and circumstances. Like, he's already working, not only in your life, but in mine. So you got to trust him. This is what if nothing else that Deborah exhibits more than anybody else in this story, is that she trusts God. She says, hey, in verse 7, then the Lord will lure Sisera's commander of the army, Jabin, and his chariots, and he will hand them over to you. She says that in verse 7. She reiterates it in verse 14. This is the day that the Lord will hand over to you this particular army. And so, what we see from 14 to 17 is he does just that. If you look at verse 16, Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as the Harosheth of the nations, and the whole army of Sisera fell by the sword, and not a single man was left. I skipped a really significant part because I want to tell you something I think is really interesting about this text, and it doesn't particularly say this, but it's really understood, and I'll tell you why. You got to be asking yourself the question, how do the 900 chariot, iron chariot riders, how do they get stopped? How does God hand these people over to them? This is what it says in verse 15. The Lord threw Sisera and all his charioteers and all the army into a panic before Barak's assault. And for the longest time, I just thought maybe it was like a confusion of the mind. Maybe he caused something to happen. And I went to Israel several years ago, and this isn't in the text. I don't know to what validity this is true. But in the history of Jewish theological understanding of the Bible, what happens in this particular situation that causes the army to be thrown into panic, are you ready for this? Is it rains. The valley where this battle would have taken place is it's a really muddy valley. It used to be a river basin at one particular time, and then it dried up a long, long, long time ago. So the valley naturally, whenever it rains, it doesn't get just muddy, but it gets really muddy. And this is what our tour guide lady said during this time, but the historical understanding of this passage, practically what happened is, what did God do to throw these people into a panic? He made it rain. You know what will stop iron chariots? Mud. You know what I mean? What's the practical application that's here? God uses anything and everything to bring about his purposes. God uses all the faculties of this world. Verse 23, we'll skip to the end. That day God subdued King Jabin and the Canaanites before the Israelites, verse 24, and the power of Israelites continued to increase against King Jabin and Canaan until they were eventually destroyed. A quick thought. In Judges chapter 1, 2, 3, and now we're in 4, it's very possible that there's at least several hundred years that have passed in this particular time. But they keep going under through a particular cycle where they worship other gods, and then God sends an oppressor. The oppressor dominates them, even destroys them sometimes. God sends a hero redeemer. The hero redeemer redeems them, and there's peace back in the land. And the cycle happens a whole bunch. So it should bring up the question in your mind, how do I handle my own habitual sin? Like there's sin struggles that and it's not that I just go through them once, but I go through them a whole bunch of times. Two truths. God didn't make your life for you to constantly be wrestling with habitual sin. Like God will deliver you over that habitual sin if you ask it of him. He will. He'll give you victory. I'll say this. But there are some sins that you are going to do, encounter, and live in this life that God will always forgive you of, but this life will not. Like if you murder somebody, you're probably going to go to jail for a while. And even though God will forgive you, he'll forgive you of any sin. Like you might just have to sit in jail for a while, though. So back to the this life bit. The goal is that you trust God and you give him all of your life so that you don't put yourself in a situation to where the rest of your life is going to be compromised. Does that make sense? Like, it would be a great thing if you trusted God enough that you never got to the place where murder was an actual thing that you thought about and thought about implementing. that it was a real solution. And I'll just say this, that's an extreme one, but this happens with drugs, relationships, financial situations, all kinds of stuff. Is that we get away from God, we habitually repeat the same sin cycles, all kinds of stuff, in our relationships, our finances, and all these kind of things. And what happens is over time, it ends up, and we just, what seemed to be like a crazy thing to start with, because we've done just small amounts of sin all along the way, it becomes a very real thing. So you would never say in one day, hey, the next day I'm going to get up and be a murderer. But if you let age or rage, anger manifest and matriculate out in your life, and you don't really handle it in the best way, and you never seek any kind of help to actually work through, like what happens when you get mad, like at some point in time in your life, in your own mind, if you don't have the right people around you living for the right purposes and cause, you're going to get to a point where murder is the most sensible solution to you. And what God would say is don't do it. Just don't do it. Like, you know that it's happening. You know that it's there. Trust God enough that when sin enters into your heart and your life, that you rely on Him to move around it, to work through it, to confess it. I think that's the story, my friend. Is that there was just a lot of things that were shipwrecking his marriage. And a lot of them had to do with visual stimulation. And he never told anybody. He never said it. He never put it out there. And so when the retreat came and God busted him open, it just all came. And listen, God makes tons of beautiful messes a lot better. But he can't fix a mess that you won't allow him to see. And so, what I want you to know out of this whole passage, that God's truth is trustworthy. Like, you can trust God with your life. And what we see with Deborah, with Barak, and the other Israelites out of this particular story, if anything else, is that they trusted God. They trusted God with their life. They trusted God with their actions. They trusted God with the fulfillment that He was going to bring about what He said that He was going to bring about. Let us go to the Lord in prayer. Father God, we love You and we thank You that You're real to us, that You make our hearts whole when we're satisfied in You. So God, this morning as we close out in a time of invitation, God, what I pray is if there's anybody in here today, God, that they've never trusted You, they've trusted in other things, they've gone about their life in a particular way, but God, this morning, they want to give their 365 days of the year for the rest of their life solely to You. God, I'll be up here at the front this morning. I'd be happy to lead them in a time of prayer to trust You with their lives. But God, ultimately, if we're in the room, some of us have probably already trusted You, but we might be in a place right now where we just need to trust You a lot deeper. There's areas in our life that are just hidden. God, as we sing this last song, God, what I pray is we would have a time, either at the altar or in our seats, or maybe just standing, just singing, where we would commit our lives to trusting You with every single part of our lives. God, we thank You, we love You, and we praise You. In Jesus' name, amen.